Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. Mike, how's your love of poetry today?
Always good. Always good.
Always good?
Yes. Yes.
The song lyrics are like poetry, I think. Or they are poetry.
Yeah, though most of the great songwriters profess that it shouldn't be read as poetry, that it is a,
it's meant to be
subtly,
sung.
It's a subtly different art, but it certainly scans like poetry often.
Even though there are some of the great oral poets of the oral tradition are singers, too.
Yeah.
We have two great poets with us here today on West Coast Live. I just want to read the first line that sort of ties in with what we're doing here today.
All right.
From a poem called Distances by Evan Boland. The radio is playing downstairs in the kitchen. The clock says 8 and the light says winter. You're pulling up your hood against a bad morning. Mm-hmm. She writes on themes that take in the details of daily life. The other guest, Robert Bly, takes on themes of daily life and also spirits of the soul, and he also has one of the greatest poetic memories that I've encountered. His large work, Iron John, a book about men, a great bestseller. Evan Boland is Irish. She's been a writer in residence at Trinity College and University College Dublin. She's currently at Stanford University. Please welcome Evan Boland and Robert Bly to West Coast Live. They're participating in the Marin Poetry Festival. How do you do? Thank you very much for coming in. How do you do? Let's see you again. Yeah, right there. Comfortable sitting there? How well do the two of you know each other?
Well, I've had the pleasure of knowing Robert since he came to Stanford, which was really at the start of this quarter as the Moore visiting poet. But of course, I know his work a long, long time.
So how does he measure up in person to the work you've seen on the page?
He's the most generous and gracious and open guest you could imagine as a poet. And so we're thrilled to have him.
And Evan, that is the correct pronunciation?
Yes.
Evan has been writing poetry also for years. You've known her work?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so similar to you.
Yeah, it's a great honor to be invited by her to come.
Is there a collective noun for poets like there is for birds?
No, I don't think so. Just smart people.
A sonnet of poets, I don't know, dithyramb of poets. What even was your first impulse to be a poet?
You know, it's sometimes hard to remember, but I do think in every single culture, there's a difference between writing poems and being a poet. And, you know, I do think I wrote poems, but I do think I became or thought I was a poet much later than I wrote poems. I mean, much later than I wanted it to be.
When was your first publication?
Well, it's easy. You know, Patrick Cavanagh once said, you know, the standing army of Irish poets never falls below 50,000. So it wasn't really, just wasn't hard to get published. So I think I was probably about 17. I had a poem in the Irish Times, you know, but it wasn't anything to do with that. It was much later that I thought of myself as a poet.
And was that an epiphany or was it just sort of a realization that you'd sort of transformed from poet writer into poet?
Really wasn't an epiphany. It was really just the thought that I wanted to do this so much. I wanted to get better at it. It was only that.
And your poetry has been described as focusing on the domestic inner world.
Yeah, I think if I wanted to have a title, I was never going to be any good as a nature poet of any kind. But I would have liked and would like to be an indoor nature poet. I think of myself.
Indoor nature poet?
Yes, I think of myself a bit like that.
Dealing with the aspidistra and the
corner? No, not the aspidistra, unfortunately. More the things that are around you in your life, the things that are just available that become so much part of your consciousness, sometimes get overlooked.
And sometimes it involves the children in a household and the daily chores and the very subtle relationships between a married couple.
Yes, and I think Robert has been exemplary in this in his work. I mean, you want to put the life you have into the poem you write. Otherwise, it doesn't live. The life isn't honored and the poem isn't written. So that's what I wanted, but didn't find it that easy in Ireland.
Robert Bly, was there something today that you looked at and you said, I want to write a poem on this, or a poem came to you?
No, but I remember your question about getting into poetry. And it usually has something to do with Ireland. And I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and the wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, and a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the vales of the morning to where the crickets sing, where midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now. Can you hear all these vowels?
I was just going to ask you about, isn't it wonderful we have vowels?
Vowels. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. When I stand on the roadway or on the pavements gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core. Well, that turned me from a farm boy into a poet. More or less.
More or less. And, but there's something about the way that you're able to use those vowels to bring a kind of different kind of wind and atmosphere into a poem.
Well, it's I think the length of the sound. How long can you keep a sound going? And the English have a lot to do, you know, so their poems tend to have short vowels. But the Irish don't have so much to do. They don't have any empire, you know. And so they can sit around and use long vowels. So long vowels are like God in poems.
Whatever that means, he just said.
Well, you know, I think Robert said it all. I certainly won't add to that.
Well, so what is a famine road? There's a poem in which you talk about a famine road.
Oh, well, in 1847, after the, you know, the worst year of the Irish famine, the relief committees came from Britain and they gave, you know, they were meant to give food to the people, but they wouldn't give it to them unless they worked. And, of course, the people had no strength to work. They were really weakened by hunger and fever. Sometimes when you look down in the woods in Ireland, you can see these roads that give out and go nowhere. And they're where the people died building them. And they're the scar tissue of that history in many ways.
And so was it an illusion that they would get food, that there was... Did they know that they were making the end of their road?
Well, the heartbreak was that they had nowhere to go, and they thought that they would get food if they complied with the relief committees. But really, it was just a terrible, toxic arrangement that broke them down and ended up as inhumane.
We see increasing food shortages around the world, you know, famine, rising food prices, and so forth. What do you think is an appropriate poetic response? Is there one?
I think there's an appropriate human response. I think that you know, famine defined the Irish people, and it showed them as an absolutely defenseless people, and it's terrible to think of any people in want.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
No.
All right. No thoughts at all?
No, I think she said it beautifully. It's not a poetic problem, it's a human problem. Yeah.
There was an interview where you were asked, because you write poems about, in many ways, everyday things, whether you felt an iPod was worth writing a poem about. And you felt you didn't know where the center of an iPod was.
No, I mean, I like iPods and I like technology, but it's going to be another poet into whose poem the iPod creeps. not me, but it would never occur to me that it shouldn't come into a poem. It just hasn't in my way.
So everything really is sort of fair game in the course of life.
Yes, I think that, you know, I think things come into poems, and when they settle there, they look natural and it doesn't seem to be odd. But before they come into a poem, it doesn't look like they can come in.
Robert Blyde, when do you know that one of your poems is finished?
When I get tired of it. No, that's a joke. But, because if you really finish a poem, you're never tired of it. But in a certain sense, the poem is finished when the sounds all work together and it appears to be, it's like a musical form. And when the musical form is finished, the poem's over. If you haven't said what you wanted to say, too bad. Try it again some other time.
Robert Graves wrote that if you could feel the shiver of the muse, you knew that the poem was working and had connected with the muse in some way.
Well, he didn't. It didn't connect too many times with him.
So So much for the White Goddess, huh?
His prose books are great, but the poems are terrible.
Goodbye to all that. The I, Claudius, Claudius.
Yeah, that's tremendous stuff.
And that was a way that he chose to make a living, was by writing historical novels.
That's right. Yeah. Probably better than teaching at a university. I don't mean that you shouldn't know. But it's hard to know how to make a living. And I turned out to be an introvert that had extrovert tendencies. And so I'm able to make a living by giving poetry readings, which I like. I go in, don't have to see anybody afterwards, go home and use the money. And she's been kind enough to invite me to Stanford this year. So, but I don't have much work. I just have one class for 3 hours every day, and I treat it like a poetry reading. And
I just wanted to quickly say, in case people think we're grinding, it's not every day. So
is that every day? Once a week.
But it's just unquantifiable how much it means to undergraduates to have someone like Robert Bly in that classroom who gives just that witness of his own wonderful work, of what it means to be a poet over a lifetime. That's the real education, and we're fortunate through this Moore, Larry and Nancy Moore's endowment, to be able to bring this to into a classroom. It's just an unforgettable thing. And though Robert might quite, you know, might have hesitations about teaching or universities or structures, those things last long into people's lives that they've seen that.
Well, the idea about structure is that every poem needs a structure, needs a container to hold it. I mean, even the shapes of the letters are containers, mm-hmm. are structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've said it.
Okay. Was it difficult to get him to come out to teach?
Well, we were just very hopeful, and it worked out. And, you know, I can understand. I mean, he was very gracious about doing it, and we're thrilled. I mean, we never assumed that Robert would come, but we hoped we could tempt him. And it's a beautiful part of the world. It's a wonderful university, and Ruth and he came, and we're thrilled.
So one reason I came is because you invited Lee Young Lee earlier. He's one of the best of the American poets now, a wonderful, wonderful man. I think his father was a doctor for Mao Zedong, ended up in prison. So then I think he got out of prison, he became the doctor for Sukarno, ended up in prison. This is his son. So he's a person with a whole tradition of Chinese literature behind himself, as well as one.
As well as a sort of family tradition of working with powerful people and imprisonment.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought it was great that they'd invite him, because he's eccentric. I don't know any other eccentric people, do you? No.
How do students ask in your classes? I don't know what level they are, but do they ask how to respond to our time of war in writing?
They didn't, but I brought in a little book I wrote called Poetry Reading Against the Iraq War, just in case they didn't know. About all that. And they all took it home and haven't said anything to me about it since. But but I really, you know, I'm one of the 60s people, and we don't believe in leaving out war and anti-war material. And no one wanted to print it, so I printed it myself. And this is an awful time, you know, with Bush, the worst president that's ever been in the history of the United States, and it's going on and on.
Yeah.
And the cruelty in his face, the lack of feeling, as they just, you know what I'm saying, do you? It's the first time I've ever been ashamed of the United States, right. Ashamed of the presidency. Right. So we're living in difficult times right now. It's hard to keep our spirits up. You have to remember how strong America has been in the past and understand that it can continue that way with a different president. I think one partly black, huh?
Yeah, right.
So when you see that there's this dearth of response to a war, that there's kind of a cultural denial, mm-hmm. At some level, mm-hmm. the hiding of the bodies coming back into the mm-hmm. country. I was driving along past Orinda the other day, and I saw for the first time the hillside that was painted. It was filled with all the crosses representing the people who had been killed in the war. Wow. And to see 4,000 crosses just suddenly, wow. just... you know, blithely going along. There it is.
It's next to the road?
Yeah, next to the road, next to the Highway 24.
Oh. How do you feel about this whole business of hiding the number of casualties and all of that? How does that feel to you?
I feel appalled and betrayed. Mm. I feel that there's somebody who's decided that it's better for us not to know the truth right. of what's going on. And I feel that it also, no matter whether a war is justified or not, you have to know what the costs of it are. I came across a poem that had been written by my aunt and the music by my grandmother in 1945. Mm. And it was called 10,000 Crosses. And it was my then 18-year-old aunt's response to people that she knew dying in World War II. You know, 10,000 crosses marching, 10,000 crosses. It was not a particularly happy and joyous song, but it was her response and her recognition of what people were doing in a battle. And I feel that in many ways, that's being denied us as a people. Mm-hmm. Yes. Since you asked.
Yeah, that's right. And then if it's denied to you, then in some way you can't mourn it. And it's going to be the lack of mourning for all of these people who have died, all those in Iraq that we haven't mourned. What's that going to be like in our souls in 10 years? Hmm? I'm just saying that we need someone who could help us mourn, not someone who could say, oh, everything's going to be all right, you know, and so on and so on and so on. You can get sick from not mourning. I feel it.
The history of dealing with death and war is one that poets seem to be experts on. Well, is there some way that you can tap into that mourning part?
Well, I think certainly, I mean, you can mourn. I mean, in the case of Ireland, it wasn't so much wars. It was the continual erosion of a people, you know, by colony and occupation. But I agree with Robert. I think, you know, the public mourning or the articulate mourning in a country often comes through the poetry, often comes through what remains, the lines and those things. And I think it's very important.
You have a poem there?
Well, I thought of Pablo Neruda because he was someone who did a great deal of mourning. If you looked at him, you saw a lot of suffering all the time.
You want to look for one, and I'll ask. Do you have a poem that you could read for us? This is from a new collection of yours, which has a very beautiful quilt-like cover on it.
This is a poem. It's not a long poem, called Quarantine. It is about what was mourned. Young couple in the famine left the workhouse, went back on a bitter night, and they turn up in one little memoir as found dead in a cabin on a bitter night in 1847. But the man had held her feet against his chest as she died to try to warm her. They really are not people who have names or histories, and it's called Quarantine. In the worst hour of the worst season of the worst year of a whole people, a man set out from the workhouse with his wife. He was walking, they were both walking north. She was sick with famine fever and could not keep up. He lifted her and put her on his back. He walked like that, west and west and north, until at nightfall, under freezing stars, they arrived. And in the morning, they were both found dead, of cold, of hunger, of the toxins of a whole history. But her feet were held against his breastbone. The last heat of his flesh was his last gift to her. Let no love poem ever come to this threshold. There is no place here for the inexact praise of the easy graces and sensuality of the body. There is only time for this merciless inventory. Their death together in the winter of 1847, also what they suffered, how they lived, and what there is between a man and woman, and in which darkness it can best be proved.
Even Boland. What was the core of that poem for you?
The core was my sense, which I'd had for years, that there's a great gap in a country like Ireland between the past and history. History is the official version. The past is this place of whispers and silences where people get absolutely lost. They turn up very briefly in a small memoir. They have no names, they have no background, they didn't matter. They're everybody's great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents in Ireland. And it just seemed to me that, you know, that past is where we should take some heritage from.
And it's not only applicable to Ireland, but to Africa and Asia, India.
Yeah, I think it's wherever people... I mean, I think many, many people feel that feeling for people who are left in silence while the official version goes ahead.
That's so great, the feet against the chest. That's so wonderful. What are you thinking?
Well, you had been looking for a poem.
I'll read a poem of my own. Hmm?
Oh, all right. Skip Pablo Neruda?
Well, he's quite well known.
This is from your most recent collection?
Yeah. Thing called My Sentence Was a Thousand Years of Joy, so maybe I'll read that. You tend to put the best poem last, you know.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's an old secret. Mm-hmm.
The best one last, first. You don't want to play with your hit like the track one.
No, at the end, so they got a flavor in their mouths. Oh, I'm going to read that again. That's wonderful. This is a little poem called Stealing Sugar from the Castle, and it's written in the major form of the Muslim world, which is the ghazal or the ghazal. And the qualities are you're given 36 syllables to say what you want to say, then you have to change the subject. This would have been a big blessing to Milton.
Okay, we'd better go. Yeah, we're running out of time here. Okay.
We are poor students who stay after school to study joy. We are like those birds in the India mountains. I'm a widow whose child is her only joy. The only thing I hold in my ant-like head is the builder's plan of the castle of sugar. Just to steal one grain of sugar is a joy. Like a bird, we fly out of darkness into the hall, this is from Beowulf, which is lit with singing and then fly out again. Being shut out of the warm hall is also a joy. I'm a laggard, a loafer, and an idiot. One of my boys said, Dad, you're not a loafer. I'm a laggard, a loafer, and an idiot. But I love to read about those who caught one glimpse of the face and died 20 years later in joy. I don't mind your saying I will die soon, even in the sound of the word soon. I hear the word you, which begins every sentence of joy. You're a thief, the judge said. Let's see your hands. I showed my calloused hands in court. My sentence was 1,000 years of joy.
Robert Bly from My Sentence Was 1,000 years of Joy. And Even Bolan, her book is called New Collected Poems. Thank you both very much. And they're also participating in the Marin Poetry Festival, along with Jane Hirschfield and many other poets. For more information, there's a link to it on our website at wcl.org. Thank you both very much for being here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to see you again. And that's today's West Coast Live. For more information, wcl.org, produced by Kathy Kamen Goldmark, engineered by Mitch Ullman. Safe journey. This is Edge Thompson. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Try out others from West Coast Live right here, and we look forward to having you in one of our audiences one day. For more information, wcl.org.